Hello, welcome to the Christian Leaders Institute World History 101 course. It's called The Beginnings of Civilization to 1500 AD, that is 1500 years after the coming of Jesus Christ. That is a huge amount of time, and one of the things we'll talk about is when does history really begin? But here we are at the beginning. Welcome. My name is Rich Hamstra. It's my privilege to be the instructor for this class, and I look forward to exploring this course with you. Since this is Christian Leaders Institute, I thought it was just right if we began with a prayer. So will you please join me? Father in heaven, we give thanks to you for this day, for this opportunity to study, for the learning that we will encounter. And we give thanks that you, out of all the people throughout the world, know and care for each one of us. We pray that you will bless us in this effort. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. So, here we are in the World History course. For this beginning period, we're going to talk about introductory matters. And subjects we're going to cover include ones like why in the world should we study history? We're going to talk about our assumptions. We're going to wonder, what does one study when one studies history? Important topic is about what kind of sources are used for the study of history. We'll ask, when does history begin? And then we'll see some characteristics of early civilizations. These are all introductory matters, and there are more that we'll come to. But here's where we begin. So I think it makes a lot of sense to say, why study history as a part of your CLI education? There are lots of ways we could answer that question, but here are a few things for you to note. One of the most important things that one learns when one studies history is you become aware of context. Context means that each person, each society, each culture comes in a unique time, a unique place, a unique circumstances, and for us to try and understand them apart from that context is inappropriate. We will inevitably not understand them. That's an important intellectual idea to grasp as well, that all knowledge comes in context in a particular setting. So studying history helps us to really see that. The second thing is that it's important to increase our awareness of perspective. Each of us comes with our own perspective. Each of us comes with our own cultural background, our own language, our own family structure, our own experiences. And all of those feed into how we read, how we see, how we understand things. That's our perspective. Often we try to be objective. That means we don't have a certain perspective that we try to force on the evidence or on the data in front of us. The truth is, there is no such thing as true objectivity. We all bring our perspective. The way to try to be as objective as possible is to be aware of what perspective it is we bring. Thirdly, I think the study of history helps us understand the human condition. There are lots of different ways to study history. You can study natural history. You can study animal history. You can study plant history. You can study rocks. You can study all sorts of things. This course is really about studying human development and human history. And I've reminded often of the Charles Dickens line, "It was the best of times, and it was the worst of times." The study of history will show us both. And most of it is time that's very much in between. And finally, let me just point out that as I look at the history and different civilizations, different cultures, different people, I am just impressed. I marvel at the variety of human solutions. Human beings are all confronted with basic issues: food, shelter, political organization, family structure. And there is no such thing as just one solution. People over time have found, not infinite, but an incredible variety. That teaches us about the human ability to adapt. It teaches us about the human ability to invent. Some people talk about us humans as being the creatures who make tools in order to make tools. I think that is one way to think about our adaptability and inventiveness. There are multiple ways to organize life. We're only going to touch on a few of them in this course. This slide is actually the lady in blue is my wife. She and I had the privilege of spending some time in some of the museums in Europe. I think this is at the British Museum in London. And I put it in as to emphasize the notion of perspective. You could see just this picture, but without seeing it in the context of a person standing there, you would have no idea how huge it is and how monumental it is. It was intended to be that so that it would impress people. I believe this is from Persia. It's the entranceway to the king's highway. And if you would see this great creature, who is a representation of the king with the big beard, the body of a bull, and the wings of eagles, you would have a clear understanding of who this king thinks he really is. Perspective. It's very important to understand that when we study history, we come to certain assumptions. In the Western world, we understand that time moves in a linear way. That is, history goes from one event to the next, to the next, to the next, year to year, to year to year. Sometimes there's progress, sometimes there's regress. Sometimes we do well, and sometimes it's horrible. But time moves forward. Heraclitus, who was a Greek philosopher back in the 6th century before Christ, he said, "No man ever steps in the same river twice. For it's not the same river, and he's not the same man." Now, he wasn't talking about history in that quote, but I think it really fits. It fits because if you look at a river, it looks the same often, but you step in one place, that water flows on, and you flow on in your life as well. That's our Western way of looking at time and of history. Eastern people have often a very different way. We're going to talk about China and India. In those cultures, it's much more of a cycle, a great wheel, where they talk about reincarnation as a critical idea in their theology, where they talk about history repeating itself and going through its various stages. Hopefully one can advance, but time goes round and round and round. I have to admit, here are some things that make up my assumptions. I'm a Westerner. I'm from the United States. That means I have a very much that linear idea of history. I live in the 21st century. I come from America. I was born here raised in the Midwest, and that gives me a certain perspective of things. I can only see it through that perspective. I'm a white person, not a member of a minority, and that certainly makes a big difference on how I understand and read the evidence before me. I'm no longer a child, a little over 60. I'm male. Women often read history in very different ways. Important piece of that is that I'm a Christian. And so when I look at history, I see not just the human condition, but I also hope that I can see God's hand at work. That's pretty hard to do often, but encourage you to consider that. And I've been a pastor for more than 30 years. I have served three different churches in Michigan, and two in Michigan and one in Ohio. And during that time, I've had the privilege of living with people in their great moments, baptisms and weddings and great occasions, the birth of a child, celebrations, and have walked with people through their darkest hours of illness and funerals often and trouble. I understand that life is not simple. I understand that life is not easily read. Often it takes that longer view to see how God is working things out. Often it takes a longer view to see how history works. Often it takes that longer view to understand the patterns that do reoccur. That's all part of what I bring and part of the assumptions that I have to be aware of when I look at history. So here's my challenge for you. Think about the things that make up your life. I could have mentioned some more. I've been married for almost 40 years. I have 3 sons. I have a brand new grandson. That has changed my point of view amazingly. So look at the condition of your life and realize that all of those factors weigh in. They color how you will look at historical data. Be aware of that and be humble with that. Okay? Now, assumptions. Nope, we've looked at assumptions. Let's ask the basic question. Well, what does one study when one studies human history? What is it we're looking at? Well, what we're mostly looking at are the stories and the values and the organizations, political and economic and agricultural organizations. We're looking at the various cultures, the kind of art that people produce, the kind of religions that they have. We're looking at the artifacts that are left behind. Some of those are monumental, like the picture earlier of the great king. But some are just very, very small, and yet they can be significant. We're looking at these different things for the different human groups and individuals who have lived in the past. You know, history is often the story of how people order and make sense out of their experience. That's what we can observe. It's often about how they try to control or align or get along with the perceived greater forces in their experience. The human condition is to realize, indeed, we don't control all. And how do we adjust to that? How do we live with that? So we study these human-created things, but not all purposely created. How do we find out about history? What are the sources for studying human history? Generally, there are 3 that are pointed to. Primary sources, secondary sources, and environmental sources. We'll start with primary. Primary sources are those things that are directly left behind by past people, like archaeological artifacts, which have to be carefully documented in the context. See that word again? In the context in which the object was discovered. Writings are extraordinarily important. Again, they must be carefully understood in the context in which they were written, edited, or produced. It is almost always true that the writings that we have, particularly the stories about what went on in their culture, their heroes, and the like, were not written down in real time. They were not written down when things happened. Often they were written a generation, or 2, or 3, or 4, or 10 later. Well, must respect. Yes, there's stories about what went on in the past, but when they were written and how they were written also is an important context for them. They're written to address the people who lived in their world, not just tell a story from the ancient past. So that complicates matters, I know, but has to be understood. I thought I'd throw this in. I had opportunity about 10 years ago. Oh, thank you. About 10 years ago, I had an opportunity to spend some time in the summer in England working at an archaeological site, a Roman fort called Arbia, It's in South Shields, England, right on the River Tyne. It was a supply fort, supply depot for the troops that lived and built and manned Hadrian's Wall up there in the north. So as part of that archaeological work, we sat on the ground and used our little trowels and scraped and scraped and scraped very delicately, just a centimeter at a time. We would scrape a little bit off. I found this these four stones and called the lead archaeologist over and said, "Is this anything? I have these four stones." And he said, "Oh, yes." He was Irish. And he said, "Oh, yes. Oh, that's very important." He said, you have to take great care with that. He said, "So, you know, just scrape a little bit and scrape a little bit and call me over and scrape a little bit." So I spent 2 days sitting by these four stones, scraping just layer after layer off. It turned out that what this is the stones were used, pushed into a timber, a post hole, a post, and on top of that post was built some sort of roof for people, probably, because we found some iron filings and stuff around, probably some sort of iron shop was there. This was evidence of a little building that had been built there. Didn't seem very significant 10 years later to spend 2 days looking at that. But at the time, I was discovering history. Very important. And then half a day is spent marking, showing, measuring, using GPS to show exactly where that thing was. And they could use all of that data and piece it together and in the end have a very complete picture of what that settlement there at the fort looked like. It isn't just enough to dig stuff up. You have to understand its context and record its context in order to be able to interpret it. The thing itself is of importance, but it's the interpretation that often is the key. Here's are just some other artifacts, things that are found commonly. Nails are very common, needles are very common, buttons, buckles, rings. Someone long ago lost a ring and it was dug up 2,000 some years later. And here it is now in a glass case. Artifacts left behind tell us about the people. Those are primary sources. So is the written documents from the ancient world, and we'll come back to those. But let's go now to the secondary sources. Primary sources are always just that, primary. They're the most important. But the secondary sources are significant as well. Almost all the readings that you will do in this course are indeed secondary sources. There are some primary ones, but most of the time it's secondary. Secondary sources are the interpretations. They are what someone else has written or spoken about, things in the past. They include textbooks, articles, lectures, this course, online comments, biographies, stories, things that other people have said about the past. That's a secondary source. Have to be careful with those. We have to say, do they respect the context? Do they acknowledge their perspective? Do they present all the data and not just what's convenient for their idea of what went on? Be careful with secondary sources, and yet they are extremely important. It has long been understood that the environment in which a person or a culture lives dramatically affects how they live, how their life is shaped, what they think is important. So environment becomes a very important source for understanding. If you cannot look at the nation of Greece, ancient Greece, without knowing they lived on the seacoast. And so sea power, sea trade is essential to them. you know, this type of evidence is not purposely produced by the people of the past, but it does relate to the physical or creational or natural world in which those people live. So, conditions like mountains, rivers, shorelines, forests, deserts, all of those, they require different ways that people adapt, different solutions in order for a culture to arise and to flourish. Again, must take into account the context of a people's particular environment. One of the things that historians note is that the ice ages that came and went over the northern hemisphere in the last 25 to 30 to 40,000 years tremendously affected the environment. You know, the Sahara Desert in northern Africa used to be a savanna. It had rivers running through it. It had trees. It had grass. There were cities built. People lived there. And then there are significant changes in environment so that the Sahara dried up and became, well, the great desert that we know today. That has happened time and time and time again in the natural world. And those changes lead to often large migrations of people. And when people move from one place to another as a large group, that changes the nature of civilization. One of the really exciting things going on in the study of history today is being done with the science of genetics. The genetics are used particularly, historically, to trace the various migrations. Geneticists have a way of being able to mark how people have moved from one place to the next, to the next, to the next, who's related to whom, etc. I point you to this link to the National Geographic production of the Human Family Tree. Now and then in this course, I'll recommend to you some YouTube videos to watch and maybe some articles to read. There's a big difference for you between what's recommended and what is assigned. What's recommended is simply for you to explore if you are able. You are not held accountable for what's in that recommended material. If something is assigned in the course, like an assigned reading, you are held accountable for that. Okay? This one is recommended. Now, let's ask the question, when does history actually begin? Well, those of us who know Genesis would say, well, it begins in the beginning, right? That's how the Bible starts in Genesis 1. And there is a way in which that's true. Anything and everything that's come before us is open to historical investigation. Traditionally, however, and for the purpose of this course, we're going to have to refine that. History begins, for this course, when groups of people began to use some sort of writing or record keeping. The keeping of records is a true turning point in our human culture, human development. It gives us, for one thing, a lot more recorded data for us to use, and we can see a more complete picture of their life. Generally, when historians talk about history and prehistoric, they aren't just talking about dinosaurs or something like that, but prehistoric means those times before and those cultures that do not have a written language in order to pass down. History, in a lot of ways, in an academic way, begins with writing. So, of course, we have to look at what the written word is about. Excuse me. Most often, writing arose as a form of record keeping. Bookkeepers were our first writers, and they became necessary when there was a division within a society of folks who own things and people who produced and worked for the people who own things. It becomes important for the owners to be able to have a way to say, This jar of olive oil belongs to me. This bottle of wine is produced by my people. This is my land, my slave. So as culture, as societies become diversified in their occupations and in their social levels, so generally most early cultures have owners and workers and slaves, and then they have another group of people who are warriors and some who are farmers, some just small farmers, but some who own large farms that they have other people farm for them. And then almost always at the top there develops a royalty, a royal family or royal group, and priests. As those groups diversify, it becomes more and more important to keep track of what belongs to whom. And that's how writing began. It began as a means of bookkeeping, to say, this is my stamp, this is my seal. The number of people who knew how to write, of course, was very, very small. We call them scribes. They were the folks who were able to read what belongs to whom and to make the marks on people. Those marks we call the owner's seal or stamp. It's one of the really early reasons to create systems of markings so that they could be identified by others. Just about all the earliest written artifacts that we have are either seals like this, or they're lists of inventory of property and trade goods. You know, this all belongs to this kind of tradesperson, and this belongs to this one. And they all have his mark. That's how writing got started. It, again, implies an already existing diversified society with personal ownership at a very high value. You know, before societies become diversified like that and stratified according to different social groups, there was different ways to be arranged in human communities. But once that diversification happens, we call that an ancient city, that is, a civilization. Previously, folks were much more on the move. They weren't settled in a particular place. There were the hunter-gatherers who would maybe have some cave situations, but they would migrate from one place to another where the game was. There were the nomads and pastoralists who maybe would follow their herds of goats, or they would follow herds of reindeer or yaks or whatever they would follow, bison in the American West. But they wouldn't settle in one place. And in some places, particularly in tropical areas, there were the slash and burn harvesters. They would cut down trees or cut down an area or burn it out and farm it as long as they could. But as soon as the land became depleted, they would move along. The coming of sustainable agriculture is one of the key characteristics of civilization. It really is what we might call essential. In order for people to stay in the same place, they had to know that next year they could eat again. Not just right now, but next year eat again. And so they began the cultivation of crops, almost always cereals of one kind or another. But of course, weather is unpredictable. And so how would you know your crop was going to grow? How did you know you weren't going to have a famine? How did you know there would be enough rain, or if there was a flood, that you would be wiped out? Those are all those forces that they came to deal with over and over. And people found vast numbers of ways, multiple different solutions for how to deal with those questions. But always the question would be, how are we going to eat tomorrow or next year? Cultivation of cereals, real key to the beginning of human civilization. Secondly, the domestication of animals. Now, that predates the cultivation of crops, as a matter of fact. However, in order for a city-state to arise, it needed to have a consistent animal population. They needed to have meat or fish or food from the sea. That contributed greatly to a civilization's diet and health, as well as what they could export. At one time, it was thought that irrigation was the essential element of the coming of a civilization. Well, I don't know that I would say essential, but I certainly would say it, often irrigation is a key element to the sustainability of cultivation and the establishment of a city or of a civilization. Being able to manage water is a key human issue. That's true today, as well it was back in the ancient world. I really like this picture of this fisherman. This goes back to ancient Sumer, a place that we'll get to. But what you'll observe in this picture, if you can see it clearly, is that he has them corralled. He has these fish pinned in. Oh, one is escaping, but otherwise he has them in his circle, and he has a stick that he's able to stick in them and harvest them. Here is early use of the resources that are out there. There was it's called the agricultural revolution. As the last ice age receded, and different parts of Asia, Africa, North America, South America, China, India, everywhere changed when the ice receded, agriculture began to get a start. A lot of people will place it around the year 10,000 BC. That's called as part of the Neolithic Age. Neolithic is a technical term meaning new rock. People were still using stone tools back then to farm, to hunt. But they began to figure out how to raise those cereal crops, how to harvest them, how to plant them so they'd come back the next year. It happened that agricultural revolution came strongly in different places, but we have evidence that, for instance, in the Middle East, right around the year 8000 BC, wheat and barley is being consistently produced on a year-to-year basis. By the way, you'll see Middle East and then CA. That CA means around. It's a little bit of Latin, okay? But it means around. In Greece, it was right around 6000 BC, 2000 years later, but still, because the culture then allowed it and the environment then allowed it, wheat and barley became very important. In Egypt, it was around the year 5000 BC. That is about the time the Sahara is really drying up and people are moving out of the desert and coming to the Nile River. In South China and North India, it's also around 5000 BC. There it's not wheat and barley, but it's rice that becomes the main cereal crop. And in Central Europe, around 4000, the ice has receded enough that they can begin to farm wheat and barley. In Mesoamerica is a term I'm going to try to use consistently to refer to Central America countries. And in Peru, it's around the year 3000 BC that we know that different crops are made. Not wheat and barley or rice, but potatoes and maize. Maize is an early form of corn. So the cultivation of these cereal crops, you see, all come within about a 5,000 to 6,000 year period of each other. A second very important part of the forming of civilization is what I'm going to call technological change. And one of the most significant technological changes is the coming of bronze. Before bronze, it's the Stone Age. sophisticated tools, often very sharp. Flint can be made as surgically sharp as today's scalpels used in operating rooms. But they wore out quickly. They broke easily. Someone, or some ones, discovered along the way that if you could mix in the right proportion tin and copper, you could come up with a new metal. And that metal is called bronze. The earliest understanding and evidence we have is that bronze is discovered in the Caucasus Mountain region. And I have to tell you, as I look at history and look at historical things, I see so many things coming out of that Caucasus Mountain region. They were an inventive and an imaginative and an intellectually and technologically advanced people in so many ways. Bronze probably comes from them. So you take that confluence, that coming together of sustainable agriculture, now they can have wheat that they can plant year after year after year, and the early Bronze Age, where they begin to use tools that lasted and were sharper and harder than the old stone, not harder, but that lasted longer than the old stone tools. And lo and behold, what happens? City-states begin to arise. Places like Sumer, Egypt, Greece, all have early beginnings around this age. This is simply a picture of, actually, I don't think that it's bronze. I think these are made out of iron. But along with the agricultural tools, of course, weapons are made. And war becomes not merely a clash of the various clans, but becomes nation against nation, people against people, country against country. The coming of weapons. So, let me just review a bit. Here are what I think of as four common characteristics of many, if not all, early civilizations. There has to be a sustainable agriculture. There is diversification of social and economic roles. You have owners, you have slaves, you have warriors, you have priests, you have kings, etc. There is use of new technologies. Very important, irrigation and bronze. And lastly, there is coming almost always, not in every culture, but in almost always, there arises at that time a creation of record keeping. That's going to be true in China and India and in the Middle East and in Egypt, where record keeping comes right along with the founding of these civilized places. The rise of civilization comes sometime between 5,000 and 3,500 BC. We could look in all sorts of places around the world, but we have to select some for this course. And so here are the ones that we'll talk about. We'll talk about Mesopotamia and India and China, Egypt, Peru, and Mesoamerica, that is Central America. You'll see those places highlighted with the blue circles on your map. They are diverse. Some have much connection with each other, particularly Mesopotamia, Egypt, and India were all in trade relations together from the earliest days. China comes into there very early as well. Of course, the cultures in Mesoamerica and in Peru are isolated. One of the things that means, in the rest of the world, people knew how to use that basic tool called the wheel. No one knew about a wheel until the Europeans came in 1492 AD to North and South America. Those cultures built amazing things. They had amazing sculptures, amazing temples, amazing terraced agriculture, but not the wheel. Isn't that fascinating? These are the cultures that we'll be looking at. Now, this is an important piece of introduction as well, particularly when we're talking about Asia and the Mediterranean basis. So here's your first reading assignment. This is one you'll be held accountable for. It's a brief article about the Indo-Europeans, or proto, meaning early or first Indo-Europeans. I want you to note especially the part titled Introduction through the section on culture. It's not long, but it's good reading. We don't know exactly when, but sometime around the year 3,500, give or take, a group of people, again from the Caucasus Mountains, began to move out. We don't know why. Was it because of war or because of cultural trade? Was it because they had invented the wheel and found the wheel and began to use it? We don't know why, but for some reason they began to spread in all directions. You'll see the purple area indicates the influence of these people and their basic language, which is called early Proto-European. These folks are tremendously significant in the development of so many cultures. The Indo-European influence. It's a large group. It's not an ethnic group in that they're all related biologically by some sort of same race or ethnicity. It's not a racial group. It is fundamentally a cultural and linguistic group. You saw on the map, we'll just go back. Their influence goes all the way from the British Isles, from Wales, down to Spain, all through Europe, up into the Scandinavia, all of Central Europe, much of Russia, all the way to China, down to India, and back all the way through the Middle East. These Indo-Europeans spread like wildfire. Likely originated in the Caucasus Mountain region, around between the Black Sea and the Caspian Seas, around 6,000 BC. I'll correct that date. Around 6,000 BC. They're called the Proto-Europeans. But around 3,500, they really migrated out of that area. Again, we don't know if they were refugees, if they were migrants, if they were conquerors. There isn't a lot of evidence that they were warriors or that military conquest was the main way they moved. They moved with their families. They moved with their groups. And they brought that early Indo-European language structure with them. They went to India. And the Sanskrit language, which is powerful in India history, is owing to this Indo-European influence. They went to China. They went south. And the old Persian dialect comes from, rooted in the Indo-European. They went west into Europe, and so Greek and Albanian and Germanic and Celtic and Anatolia, which is one of the many names for what we call Turkey, the land of Turkey. Anatolia, Asia Minor, Turkey, all the same place. It refers to that peninsula that sticks out there in Asia. And even into they went north into parts of southern Russia and into the Baltics. So their influence got spread far and wide. Here are some of the important things that the Indo-Europeans contributed to the cultures that they went to. And it is the case, it seems like wherever they went, they began to dominate the local culture that they found there. They changed it. We'll see that most especially when we talk about India. But they are likely the group that domesticated the horse. You know, when we talk about the domestication of animals, it's a real continuum. Some historians suspect the dog may have been domesticated as many as 50,000 years ago. The dog has been with people and has been our best friend for a long, long time. Other animals came. Pigs, llamas, camels, donkeys, goats, and a lot of fowl, particularly geese and chickens, all came. One of the last ones to be domesticated is the horse. But these folks from the Caucasus regions and then later the Indo-Europeans, they seem to have the trick to domesticate the horse, and that gave them a huge advantage and may also have contributed significantly to how they could move out so far in so many directions. They also invented the wheel. Again, huge change in human history when suddenly you can put your heavy things on something that rolls and carries your burden for you. So they were a technologically advanced people. In terms of religion, they brought, prior to the Indo-European influence, nearly all religion was connected to the Mother Earth goddess. She goes by an infinite number of names. Most often, the name is Gia, which is just Earth. The Mother Earth goddess, the female principle of divinity, was worshipped by virtually every culture. The Indo-Europeans spread a different kind of religion. Rather than worshipping Mother Earth, their main god was a god who was in the sky. We would say in the heavens. Their god was beyond this world, not this world. And this god, it was conceived of as male. They brought a patriarchal system into family dynamics, into government, into civilization, rather than the matriarchal, which dominated in the period of time when the Mother Earth goddess was the primary deity that was worshipped. So there's a huge change in religion with the Indo-Europeans and a huge change in family structure and in social structure. One of the characteristics of Indo-European cultures is that we love our heroes. We tell stories of those historic people in the past who did amazing things. And you can go from in India, they have stories of Buddha, for instance. Or you can go to Greece and have stories of Hercules and Perseus. Or you can go into other places where you have stories of the great heroes and great gods who did things. And these stories are told orally, later written, but they're told orally generation after generation after generation. That sort of hero worship, the idealization of a human being, is very much a part of the Indo-European influence. So they spread their root language and their cultural changes throughout most of the regions that we'll talk about in terms of civilization. Egypt is a real exception to that, as well, of course, as things in South and Central America. That concludes our first session together. In our second session, we'll dive in more specifically to some of the places where early civilization began. Thank you, and I hope you do well. We'll be seeing you very soon.